What I say to a lot of people today, is, especially in the U.S., who have kids, I say, don't save up for your kid's college. Save up if you want and buy their kid. You know, if their kid wants to, don't ever force your children to do anything. But if they want to, save up for a round-the-world ticket for them when at whatever age that they're ready. Tell them, go out there and find a business opportunity somewhere in the world. There's nothing but opportunity out there if that's what the kid wants. Now, if the kid wants to be a scientist where you need a certain degree, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. But if the kid doesn't want to do that, there's much more opportunity in traveling the world. And what people call risk, I call it risky to go to college in the U.S. today with all the debt you're going to go into.
Right, yeah.
Minimal job prospects for most of the things that you're going to learn in those colleges. I think that's incredibly risky behavior.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is October 13th, Columbus Day. Jesus, this day screws me up every year because you never know it's coming. And then just suddenly it's Columbus Day. So have fun, you know, not doing the errands you need to do today involving banks or post offices, etc. And in protest of Columbus Day, I thought it would be nice to hear from a man in our second installment of the Freedom of Success series who managed to have some great storied adventures in boats in the Central and South America area without any of them resulting in genocide. So that's always nice, you know, when you can have a little adventure that doesn't result in genocide and European economic collapse. That man is Jeff Berwick, and I'm very pleased and excited to welcome him to School Sucks Podcast for the first time as a guest. Of course, I have been on Jeff's program, Anarchast, twice. An honor to be a two-timer on Anarchast. You can go to the School Sucks YouTube channel and find those interviews, or you can go to Jeff's channel, which is Anarchast. And you can also find them on the website as podcasts if you've never heard them. I think they're both worth checking out. I enjoyed both conversations. In addition to Anarchast, Jeff runs The Dollar Vigilante. He's the editor and creator of The Dollar Vigilante, a financial newsletter with the tagline "Surviving and Prospering During and After the Dollar Collapse." They have obviously a membership section, but there's a good deal of free content worth checking out there as well. So that's dollarvigilante.com. Jeff is also spearheading a new project in Mexico called Anarcopoco. We talk about that just a little bit today, but we're actually going to be talking about it more in the future because I am toying with the idea of going there in early 2015 for a visit. And I might even, we're going to talk about this as well, I might even think about moving to Mexico for a while. And expatriation is one of the things that we cover on the show today. So if you did not catch the first installment of the Freedom of Success series, the basics are we want to explore the elements of entrepreneurial success and financial independence through the biographies of people who have achieved it. And these biographies will include stories about taking risk, facing failure, vision, passion, preparation, focus, flexibility, helping others, applying knowledge, and maintaining the proper attitude, as we covered in the first installment with Joby Weeks. And today we move on to Jeff Berwick, a self-made millionaire in his early 40s, who will make several, in my opinion, valuable contributions to this series on the topics of vision, curiosity, open-mindedness, and perspective. Thanks for listening, everyone. And coming up in the background right now, you hear the sounds of Snow, one of the most popular Canadian white rappers of the early 1990s. But do you know who one of the most popular Canadian white rappers of the late 1980s was? The answer might surprise you. Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go blam. I keep on bum, damn.
down. Take them on the city, they don't mess, don't stop. Somewhere down the lane, I'll keep on burn down.
Jeff Berwick, successful because of school or in spite of it?
Oh, definitely in spite of it. When I was younger, I kind of enjoyed school, I think. I think a lot of kids don't mind it until they're maybe around 11 or 12. I think things really start to change, not only in many ways, but also in your own body around that point in time. You also start to become more aware of what's going on. And so I think I enjoyed. You know, I have kids right now. I have a 7 and 9 year old, and I keep telling them they don't have to go to school if they don't want to, but they really love it. They go to a Montessori school here in Acapulco, and it's mostly just games, and they learn through games, and they come home and they're so excited every day, and I'm like, that's great. But I remember for me personally, around the age of 12, I started to just start to think, this is useless. This is a waste of my time. I know how to read now, which actually didn't take very long at all. And you don't need to go to school to read either, especially in today's day and age with texting and all that sort of thing. Kids very quickly learn that because it's a necessity. And I wasn't interested in math and that sort of stuff. So around grade, I think 7 or around that age, I remember going to biology class and physics class and social studies class, which I knew actually was mostly incorrect information that was highly propagandized about. I grew up in Canada, so it was always Canada's the greatest because of this and that. And I was like, sounds like total propaganda. I'm not getting the whole story here. So I actually stopped going to school quite a bit, and I just sit in my basement on my computer. And this is back in like 1981. So the computer had just come out. It's an Apple II Plus computer. For your younger listeners, they probably have never even heard of it. It's pretty embarrassing how bad it was. But I was just super into computers. And so I generally stopped going for the most part, but then the principal would start calling the house and he would say, hey, you know, your son isn't here very often. And my mom would be surprised because I didn't really let her know that I was just downstairs all the time. I'd actually go upstairs in the morning around 8 in the morning, take my shoes and bring them down to my bedroom. And she would just check to see my shoes were gone. And if they were gone, she figured I went to school. And this went on for quite a while. And then finally, my mom's figured out that I was really not going at all. And she said, you know, you have to go to school. And I didn't know why or I didn't understand, but I knew it was important to my mom. So I did deal with her. I said, listen, I can tell most of the teachers at the school are way stupider than me. I can actually just tell that already. They're morons. Not all of them, of course, but almost all of them. I'd always be like criticizing things they'd be doing. And then they get mad at me for pointing out their errors I did a deal with my mom, and I said, I'll just go for the tests. And if I pass the tests and I get my diploma, my badge of obedience, then everything's good, right? And she's like, okay, as long as you get your badge of obedience, your high school diploma. And so that's what I did. I'd mostly just go for the tests. I'd read the textbook the night before or the morning of, because a lot of it wasn't all that difficult. I essentially got 50% in almost every class I was in because I knew that's what I needed to pass. Experience with school was that it was a massive hindrance to what I wanted to do, which was to learn at that moment in time mostly about computers. And of course, back then, 1980s, there was no computer classes or anything like that.
Right.
And so I just considered it a massive hindrance. And then the funny part is that after high school, so I'm sitting there again and I'm like, okay, I'm free. Now I can go and learn what I want and do what I want. I can go work. I can make some money. And then my mom goes, no, you have to go to college. And I'm like, what? I didn't even have the grades to get into any university. So she said, you can get into community college. I'm like, why? And she's like, well, this is how it is. You have to do that to get a job. I'm like, I don't want a job. I want to start my own businesses and stuff. And besides, any job I want, I'm sure I can just go talk to them and tell them, you know, here's what I'm good at and get the job, like computer sort of related stuff. And she goes, no, you have to. So she made me pick a course. And so the only thing I saw in the whole community college that interested me at all was something called mass media and advertising. Something about media and advertising interested me. And I didn't know why, but I said, okay, I'll go to this one. So I went to it. And for the first few months, they actually had like a computer. They were teaching us how to do media over an old Macintosh computer at the time. This is 1989 now. And I was constantly telling the teachers they didn't know what they were doing because they didn't. And these teachers really thought they were like the most amazing people on earth. They, you know, I'm the genius of media because I did this once in the 1960s.
Right.
And they actually kicked me out. And the class they kicked me out of was called Mass Media 101 because I was constantly telling them that they were idiots. And 10 years to the day, so 1998, 1999, I was running a media company worth $240 million. So it just goes to show that no, there was, schooling was nothing but a hindrance and an irritant to me my entire life.
Right, right. Yeah, I was talking to this guy, Drew Sample, last night. He has a podcast called The Sample Hour, and he's like in his mid to late 20s. And you know, we were sharing some of our school stories, and I think you and I were lucky enough that we are at an age where if we were doing these things in school, even like 5-10 years later, we would have been drugged and arrested.
Yeah.
So we just made it in the safer time for public school. And so I wanted to ask you this, and I know a little bit about your story as a young man, but computers, kind of a retreat for you from maybe not just the academic life, but maybe the social a little bit as well.
Yes, absolutely. When I was really young, I was very outgoing, but something happened around the time puberty hit, and I became incredibly shy. And the computers didn't help, but it was a place for me to go where I felt like I could explore and do things that I couldn't do in real life for whatever reason. And it was actually a good and a bad thing, because it was bad because I didn't learn social skills until I was well into my 20s, because I was always on my computer. But it was good because I learned so much being on the computer. So this is way before the internet. They used to be called bulletin board systems. You used to actually just call someone's house, and only one person could log on to like what was a website at a time. And if you called up a guy's house and the phone line was busy, then you have to wait till that person gets off. It was really quite, and the modem speeds were like 300 baud or 1200 baud. That's like 0.3 kilobits per second. About 1,000 times slower than what we have today or more. It literally was so slow. To download a 1 megabit file would take most of the day. And that's all you could really store on your computer at the time anyway, because there was no hard drive. So you just have these floppy disks, which had 1.4 megabits on them. So yeah, it was pretty archaic, but, so yeah, it was a good and a bad thing for me, that I was on computers all the time back then. To me, it was fascinating and interesting. That's what I was interested in. And that's, I'm still to this day very interested in computers and not so much as programming as much anymore, but just the way that we can use them, like how we're using them right now, talking, you know, in high quality video face to face from, I'm here in Mexico, you're up in the free-ish state up north, and we can talk like this. And I love all the uses and the advances of the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons why I asked about your shyness, I actually wanted to move to a question. I put this in our Facebook group and I said, do people have questions for Jeff Berwick? And I got an interesting one from a listener named Sarah. I heard you say one time, when you've got a problem or you've got an obstacle and you don't know what to do, sometimes you need to do the most extreme thing. So there you are, the shy young man. And you, in addition to retreating into the world of computers, you also kind of jumped out into the world of hip hop, which when I first heard this story, I was fascinated. And unfortunately, there just wasn't enough information available about this. You know, there's hardly anything online. So what can you tell us about Jeff Berwick, the rapper?
Yeah, it's sort of a funny story. So this again goes back to the 1980s, and 1985, and the rap had just come out, hip hop. It was Grandmaster Flash and then Run DMC and things like that. And I just loved it. Something about the music really spoke to me. And at the time, I was really into heavy metal, because that was sort of the hip thing at the time. Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, AC/DC.
Right.
And I still like a lot of those groups. But then hip hop came out, and there's something so raw about about it and how they spoke all these messages. And I didn't know at the time I was a freedom lover. But a lot of what those rappers were saying, especially NWA and Public Enemy and all that, really resonated with me. So I just loved it. And so I was sitting there and I started downloading. This is, like I said, around 1985, 86. And then into 87, then the computers were getting a little bit better. And, I started to realize you could download a lot of, you know, very, very, compared to what we have today, very, archaic sort of software to make music. And there was things like beat boxes and things like that, which were actually hardware at the time. And I found it wasn't that hard to make rap music. So I started just playing with it and I enjoyed it. And I thought, man, this sucks because I'm like 18 years old and I'm so shy at this moment in time that I can't even go and talk to anybody in public. I was just head down, just incredibly shy because I had sort of spent most of my younger years, my teen years, just on my computer. And I thought, you know, my life is not going to go very well if I can't even speak to anybody in public, no matter how much I can do on a computer. It's just because at that moment in time, of course, during this entire period, I had become incredibly interested in females I had hit puberty and all that. And I was looking at them and looking at them on my computer. And I was like, oh, my God, I like this so much. But how am I going to even get to even talk to one? Because I can't. So I thought, I always do this, and this is something I did once again. I love to always do the most extreme thing possible to get myself out of a problem that I can't fix. So in this particular case, I was incredibly shy. So I thought, what's the most extreme thing I could possibly do to make myself, like force myself to change? And I thought, well, I love rap. I'll become a rapper. So I started, I not only made the music, but I also started rapping. And by the way, it wasn't very good. But for 1988, it wasn't too bad at all. Right. And actually, I became fairly popular in the area where I was from. It was played at the local clubs. So I go out to the clubs and people would be all like, you know, dancing to my tracks. And I was actually set to open for MC Hammer in 1989 in a place called Edmonton, which is where I'm from in Canada. But he actually ended up canceling that concert. But I was about to, you know, open in front of 15,000 people, doing this rap. And, but then I heard about, I was listening to all the other rappers, and especially in Canada where I was from, because Canada has this government regulation. They have to play a certain amount of Canadian music on the radio. It's really ridiculous. And Canada's just ridiculous with so many of those things. And they still have that today. So that's why you only hear like Bryan Adams and Alanis Morissette on the radio just looped all day in Canada. So I was kind of like thinking, well, you know, if I want to get a start, I'm going to have to compete with the other Canadian artists who are out there right now. And there was a bunch of black or dark-skinned rappers who were really good, people that you've probably never heard of, people like, I forget his name off the top of my head. Anyway, you've never heard of him. Yeah. And then I thought, well, you know, I have to make a niche for myself. So who's the best white rapper in Canada? And the best one, and not many people know this, was Tom Green,
right,
who's the actor now. And he had a group called Organized Rhyme, which is a pretty cool name. They had a track called Check the OR. Check the OR, you like it so far? You can actually look it up. They actually just remixed it recently, and it's really good. And so I was listening to that, and I'm like, oh, Tom Green kicks my butt. You know, like, I'm never even going to beat Tom Green, much less, you know, Vanilla Ice or whoever else, any other white rapper I want to compete with. And so I quit rapping at that moment in time. But through that, I actually had become less shy. And then I went on to produce music for other people because that was what I started to get better at, was all through the computer. I'd do everything through computers because that's what my base was. I actually didn't know how to play any instrument whatsoever, but I did so many songs that you wouldn't believe that I had no idea how to make music with like my own hands. I could do it all through computers and samples and mixing samples and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of like today. A lot of the people that you hear on the radio today, they're not very good artists at anything, but they can really change it all with all the computers in the studio. Through all that, I just became less shy. And then it just went on and on to the point where today, finally, at 43 years old, I'm not shy whatsoever. I can talk to anybody, but it took all that time. And actually, even just public speaking and things like that. When I first started speaking, what I'm doing today with the Dollar Vigilante and things like that, it was very uncomfortable to be speaking in front of hundreds or thousands of people. I used to drink a few glasses of wine or whatever before 4 to get comfortable, but I enjoyed that as well because I'm now at the point where I'm totally comfortable speaking in any situation. It took only 43 years, but the first thing I did, like I said, was start rapping when I was 18, and that helped to get me to just get out there in public.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you this. Did this, when facing an obstacle, do the most extreme thing? Did it ever backfire?
Well, it depends on how you look at things, because another example would be that I decided to travel the world by sailboat once, and I had never sailed before, and I just pushed off and almost sank it twice the first night. But I kept going for about a year, and I made it to El Salvador, and then I sank it. But I was actually a pretty good sailor at that point, because it had been a year. So it's all how you look at it. Some people will look at that and go, oh, look, he took a chance and he sunk a sailboat. But I look at it as that was an incredible experience that actually really changed my life in many ways, because it taught me, for one thing, I was living on the boat. I had moved onto the boat. Everything I owned was on the boat, and it sank. And so when I went to the shore in El Salvador, I had to pretty much, you know, I was just in my a pair of shorts. That's all I had. And I hadn't managed to put my credit card into my pocket. And so I just lived completely free from that point on for a number of years. So it's all how you look at things. So many people look at, it's all perspective. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And that's, you know, I didn't make that saying up. I think people have said that before. And it's completely true. And I think risk-taking, done properly. Now, a lot of people say I'm a huge risk-taker. I don't see it that way. For example, with the sailboat, I've always said, you know, the worst thing that happens is the boat sinks, then I'm in water. Well, I've got life jackets, I've got rafts, I've got SOS mayday calls I can make. It's not that dangerous. It's all how people think about risk. I don't see myself as a massive risk taker. If everything I've ever done, including rapping and all that, I was just trying things, and I didn't get hurt. It wasn't like I couldn't rap well and then I got killed. it was like, no, I just stopped rapping and then I tried something else. You know, people, what I find in the world today a lot is people are so much less risk takers than at any time in human history. Mm. If you just look back at anyone before the 1900s or even in the early 1900s and what they did, people like the old people who used to sail around the world when they thought the world was flat and, you know, they would took massive risks and they'd end up getting scurvy and all kinds of things, or they'd sail all the way over from Europe, all the way over here. If they survived that and they didn't even know where here was, you know, these are the first explorers, they'd get to a place like this and then all the natives would try to kill them. And then, you know, and they'll survive that and they'll end up taking over, which actually is kind of, I don't like how they did it, but they did it anyway. And then you talk to people today and they're like, oh, I don't know if I was going to move to Mexico. I don't know if I have enough money because, you know, I've only got $1,000 and the flight's like $300. And then what if I get there and I can't find, it's like, man, does anyone take any risks anymore? Like at all? Like people are just so risk adverse. I think it's because of the media. They like to put fear and fear and fear constantly into people. Life isn't all that super dangerous. I would say that for most people, they just don't take enough risks.
Right, absolutely. So obviously with like a lot of these endeavors, there is great risk, whether we're talking about entrepreneurship or sailing or rapping. And I guess what you're saying, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, is that part of it is having the right attitude first, having an attitude that is adaptive, right? So you don't, it's not always like, well, if I fail, how am I going to recover? Or how do I deal with these setbacks? And I think maybe, you know, there are times where it is important to, you know, have a plan for doing that. But having the right attitude first is like, okay, well, if suddenly I'm being pulled out of the ocean, or if, you know, a business fails or some other kind of venture doesn't work out, what's the opportunity in that?
Yeah, it's people today, there's so much opportunity and so much less risk. Like the world's never really been safer in terms of your actual ability to live. You just look at this Ebola thing right now, and I don't know what's going on, and I doubt it's as dire, as grave as they say it is, just like swine flu and bird flu and every other one they've had for decades. But you just see, like, even that, a few people in Africa are dying. Well, let's shut down the whole world to make sure no one ever dies from it. Like, the world's gone so extreme to making sure, are trying to make sure, you can't stop nature, to make sure that no one ever dies or no one ever gets hurt. And people have really gotten warped by that, to thinking that, you know, the most important thing is safety. That's what you hear so much now. Safety, safety, safety. Mm. Oh, you can't even ride a bicycle without a helmet and shin guards and knee guards. What if you scraped your knee? Well, when I was a kid, you know, I know I'm sounding like an old person now, because that's what old people say is when I was a kid. But I remember just, you know, wiping myself out on my bike. I had like no skin on either of my hands or half of my face after one crash. I learned from that. You know, there's a lot to be said for not being too safe. To me, the whole world today is skewed way too much towards safety. And not to say that you shouldn't take precautions,
right?
And not to say that you shouldn't evaluate risks and rewards, but I think it's far too skewed to safety right now. I just hear it so much, and it sounds so a little bit pathetic to me, just how people are talking. Like, if you think about people who went to the U.S. from almost anywhere in the world, like 100 years ago.
Immigrants,
immigrants, right, to Ellis Island in 100 years ago. The average person showed up, usually without shoes. They didn't really know where they were going. There was no internet to check it out. They just heard that there was this place where there might be an opportunity to get ahead.
Right.
The average person showed up to Ellis Island with $90 in today's dollars in their pocket, so enough to live for a couple days. And they survived. And you look at people like during the Vietnam War, when the U.S. Empire created a false flag attack in the Gulf of Tonkin to go and attack and kill millions of people over in Asia. A lot of them wanted to get out of there, and a lot of them, for whatever reason, wanted to go to the U.S. They'd go in like container ships across the ocean.
Right.
Most of them would die along the way or eat each other along the way. Once they got to the U.S., they didn't know anyone. They didn't speak the language at all. They didn't have any money. And pretty quickly, they had the little Vietnamese restaurant. They made a life for themselves. And now today, you have kids who have parents and, you know, who have lines of credit and who have money and who can give them a few thousand dollars if they need it. And, for example, what I say to a lot of people today, especially in the U.S., who are parents who have kids, I say, don't save up for your kids' college. Save up if you want. And then when they're old enough, and that might not be 18, that could be 14 or 15 or 16. These age arbitrary limits are ridiculous. The U.S. has the oldest children in the world today. They're really, after people get out of college, they're like 25 and they still have never worked a job and they don't know how to do anything. It's ridiculous. But what I say to parents is to save up and buy their kid, you know, if their kid wants to. Don't ever force your children to do anything, but if they want to, save up for a round the world ticket for them when at whatever age that they're ready. And tell them, go out there and find a business opportunity somewhere in the world. There's nothing but opportunity out there if that's what the kid wants. Now, if the kid wants to be a scientist and he wants to do certain things where you need a certain degree, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. But if the kid doesn't want to do that, there's much more opportunity in traveling the world and taking a few, what people call risks. I call it risky to go to college in the U.S. today with all the debt you're going to go into.
Right. Yeah.
Very minimal job prospects for most of the things that you're going to learn in those colleges. I think that's incredibly risky behavior.
Well, yeah, absolutely. First of all, as far as the safety thing is concerned, the two highest values in Western society today seem to be safety and fairness. And if I remember correctly, those were the two highest values in my elementary school. So, yeah, I guess if you can say one positive thing about school, it does prepare us for citizenship. But as far as the college versus travel thing, you know, this is one thing that this criticism that was always leveled at me when I would talk to people about basically the philosophy of liberty. You know, I would be critical of things that were happening in the U.S., really with the U.S. government, because people have a hard time separating, you know, the physical country or society of the United States from the government. It's all just one thing to most people. So criticizing the government is, you know, you hate America. I mean, that's real. That happens. But one of the things people would say to me is like, oh, you just need to get out and travel more. You need to see more of the world, because then they said to me, then you would appreciate living in the United States. But maybe starting with sailing to El Salvador, you found that that might not be the truth. You might not have a greater appreciation for America.
It's all perspective. I've heard that a million times, of course. And here's what's going on. Those people who are telling you that, they really like how the U.S. is very structured.
Yeah.
They like that there's cops on every corner. They like that if someone doesn't stop at a stoplight, that they get accosted and they get extorted for money. They like that because they see that as order and civilization, which is fine if that's what they like. But they're forcing it on other people through the political system. But if that's what they like, that's fine. But what happens is a lot of those sort of people who really like that, they just think that's the right way that life should be. They'll go to any other place almost outside of the Western world, and they'll get very scared. They'll be like, well, people here can drive whatever speed they want. That's very scary to me. It's so funny for me here in Mexico. We have a small hotel here in Acapulco. And so I've met a lot of American clients that come down, and some of them are just so scared. They're like, well, what's the speed limit here? I'm like, well, there really isn't. Just don't hit anybody. And they're like, oh my God. You know, like, there's no one to tell us to slow down. It's like, no, you just use your common sense things like that. And even right now, actually, all the traffic police have been on strike for the last few months. And actually, the traffic's been running great, because people are just not really stopping at a stoplight. If there's no oncoming traffic, they'll just, treat it as a caution and just make sure there's no traffic coming and then just keep going. And traffic's been a lot better. And actually, the traffic police want to come back now, and no one wants them to come back. So it's all perspective, because a lot of these people who say these things, they're like, well, if I go to Paraguay, there is no health insurance, from the government, or things like that. And it's like, well, just buy your own. These international health insurance is about $600 a year or something. It's very cheap. A lot of the people who say they don't like these other places are mostly coming from a state of mind that they like all this massive structure that is in the U.S., which is now actually destroying the U.S., and they don't even realize it. All the regulations, for example, they'll go to Thailand and they'll say, well, I just bought street noodles at the street cart run by some guy who's checking to make sure it's clean. It's like, well, that guy is, because if he ever serves you something bad and you get sick, he loses his business. No one will ever eat there again. So they just don't understand freedom. It's funny because you're trying to explain freedom to Americans, which is very hard to do. They just seem to have no concept about it anymore whatsoever. They have no faith in the free market, and they think government needs to regulate everything for the most part. Even your average conservative, who used to be more of the free market sort of side of things, they've become very, very statist. They think there's regulations needed for the most part, or at least somewhat. They think that you need this massive military defense system or else people are going to attack us, which is completely impossible in the U.S. with 300 million guns in the U.S. as the Japanese emperor, who had just been cut off from oil supply during World War II, which caused the Pearl Harbor attack. Said no country would ever attack the U.S. There'd be a rifle behind every blade of grass. And it's totally correct. The largest army on Earth is actually American hunters during hunting season. The people who say these things are coming from a very skewed thing, and they're very scared of different cultures as well. A lot of the time, those sort of people, they'll go to a place like, say, Mexico, which is totally not scary whatsoever. I think it's way scarier to go to the U.S. with all the police and all that sort of a thing.
Sure.
They'll come down, they'll stay in like one of these all-inclusive gated hotels, and they won't even go out, and they're just very scared. And it's funny because, again, U.S., many Americans will say, oh, this is the land of the brave, home of the brave, land of the free, or whatever it is. It's totally ridiculous because it's one of the least free countries on earth at this moment in time, in almost every metric. No one there is brave. They're so scared. Not no one. There's obviously, I hate to generalize, there is a lot of Americans who aren't scared and I see them traveling around all the time. But the majority of Americans in general are just fearful of everything, including things like Ebola. I just watch the news and I'm just like, okay, what are they going going to scare Americans with this week? And it's been Ebola this week. Then it was ISIS. So now it's ISIS, John McCain's gang of thugs that right. he used to hang out with a year ago in ARM. Now they are going to destroy us all. And then people kind of didn't really believe that for a little while. And then they said, now it's Corazon. It's 50 guys. They can put a bomb in toothpaste and they can light their clothes on fire and blow up things. So therefore, we need to take over the entire Middle East and create a police state in the U.S. Because a few YouTube videos of that looked totally fake, and actually the media said probably was fake, of beheadings, was, you know, it's crazy. Everything about the U.S. is crazy, and that's why I like to be outside of it. And I like to make sure I don't watch the U.S. news at all, because it gets your heart racing, it gets you feeling fearful. And as soon as you turn it off, it's like, oh, everything's fine. Look,
that's so, yeah, that's really true. You know, your story, it reminds me of this the ongoing argument that I had with a girl I was dating like 7-8 years ago. And we had some money and we were trying to plan a vacation, and she wanted to go to Sandals Resort in Cancun. And I said, listen, being around a bunch of people from Long Island complaining about the humidity is not my idea of a vacation. I want to go someplace. I want to actually have a vacation. I want to, you know, a vacation from this culture. But she was like, well, you want to just go and wander around in Mexico? Like, we'll get beheaded. And that is really like, I we're going to get into this in a few minutes, but, you know, I started talking about this exploration I've been doing of moving to Mexico for a while. And yeah, I mentioned it to my father. I was just at a family thing, and he's like, well, gosh, that sounds dangerous. You know, so I think that perspective is part of it in a lot of ways. But when it comes to, because this is a series about greater financial independence, when it comes to things like entrepreneurship, it's really not that subjective. Like there are, I heard you say this and I thought it was really inspirational. Like there are so many opportunities elsewhere in the world. You can make things happen so fast outside of the United States. If you have an idea, if you have a vision and a little bit of capital, or in some cases none, you can make things happen elsewhere.
Yeah, there's it's I the last place I'd really go to start a entrepreneur and enterprise would be the U.S. To me, the U.S. has the worst of both worlds. It has a lot of very business-minded people and fairly entrepreneurial-minded still, to some extent, people. Who really focus all day and all night about making money, which is fine and good in many respects, but they kind of should balance that off a little bit with actually living a decent life. At the same time, they have so much regulation now. To open a lemonade stand, John Stossel did the math. It was something like $40,000 it would cost to open a child's lemonade stand. It'd take about 6 weeks to go through all the permits, your health permits, you need insurance. And there's actually a thing, a group in the U.S. called, I think, Free Lemonade or something, because there's been so many lemonade stands shut down right. by SWAT teams, literally yep. cops showing up in riot gear, shutting down lemonade stands. So it's become that bad in the U.S. Now, and it's so funny hearing from people from the U.S., and not to mock them, but it is just funny for me to hear how they'll say things like, what if I went to Nicaragua and I wanted to start a lemonade stand? Would that be possible? It's like, of course. like no problem. You just need some lemons and some cups. There you go. Done. And same thing for anything, a bar or a restaurant, almost anywhere in the world. Now, you have to know the local culture. You have to get the biggest thing, and this is something that you have to do everywhere, is just make friends locally and figure out yep. what's going on and ask some people. You know, you can't go anywhere and not make friends and do well. You have to integrate somewhat into the local community, and that doesn't necessarily mean you have to learn really well the local language right. because most places, and this is another advantage that Americans have, is most places, most people speak some English, and definitely there's always somebody who speaks some English. You look at Chinese people, for example. I've traveled the world. I've been to about 100 countries, and I can't remember a place where there hasn't been some Chinese restaurant in the middle of nowhere. I've been in the middle of like almost the forest, you know, in a place like Mexico. I was in a place called Turtle Bay. which is on the Baja Peninsula. I was on my sailboat. I had to stop in because there was a bit of a tropical storm happening. And we walk into the town. This is a tiny little town. There may be 300 people in this town. And the only restaurant in the town was a Chinese restaurant, which is actually ran out of a house. It was actually in their kitchen, which had like a window which you could walk up to and order some Chinese food. And the people there didn't speak Spanish and they didn't speak English. They just spoke Chinese, but they were just running a little Chinese restaurant out of their house in Mexico. You look at people like that, and there's a Chinese restaurant in almost every city, every country on earth, and a lot of time they don't speak the local language or anything. They're just making Chinese food and taking local currency for it, and that's it. So Americans have a huge advantage in that respect. You have to learn the local sort of customs. For example, I heard one story. So you're always going to hear some bad stories, of course. But whenever I hear the bad stories, I always ask a few questions, and I find out very quickly why it didn't work out. So for example, I heard one story of a guy who went to like Cancun, which, you know, is a very touristy area, which isn't very Mexico-like in any respect. The police are very American style. Mm-hmm. The currency is the US dollar for the most part. It's very Americanized. And a guy went there and he tried to start up a little, he was renting out, some sort of like, surfboards, something along those lines. But there was a lot of other Mexicans on the beach who were also doing that. And so he was competing with them, and they were all on the beach, and one of the Mexicans called the cops and said, hey, that guy isn't allowed to do that. And so he actually was told he couldn't do that anymore. So then I saw online, oh, Mexico isn't as free as I thought it was. It's like, well, try that anywhere except for Cancun and Cabo, and don't go somewhere where there's other Mexicans on the beach with the same business and compete with them. If you don't know anyone in the area, of course they're not going to like it as much, and then they might cause problems for you. So find something that they're not offering, and do it in an area where it's going to be less sort of Americanized, where there is more of a free market. For example, here in Acapulco, you could pretty much do anything you want. Just start up any business. You just rent. If you want to start, I'll give you an example of a great place right now to start a business is Cambodia. Mm. Cambodia is, for younger people looking for an opportunity, is one of the best places on earth by far right now, because they went through long little history lesson here. They went through a bit of communism, or tried communism. Pol Pot took over, killed almost everybody in the country, and that was about 20 years ago. And then they went through a period of turmoil for about 10 years. And then about 10 years ago, it all just stopped. And everyone said, that's enough. No more government, no more anything. Let's just try to live and survive and make money. And so it's a very free market. There's hardly any government involvement at all. It's very rare to even see police or anything. And you can literally in Cambodia, and this was about 5 years ago, it's changed a bit now. It's getting, it's growing tremendously. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, you could rent a place probably for about $30 a month, a little place, you know, small, 1,000 square foot sort of little place, in a fairly main area. Just buy a few beers and a bottle of tequila and a bottle of absinthe or whatever you want to buy. Get a few of the local pretty girls to work there for about $3 to $5 a day plus tips, and start up a bar. And you could actually make, you know, $20-$30 a day, which is more than enough back then to live. Rent an apartment's probably about $100 a month back then. Now today, I would probably triple those numbers or quadruple them. And that's what I said actually when I wrote about it back then. I said, this isn't going to last forever.
Right.
So now I actually heard that to start a decent bar, it's probably going to cost you $1,000 or $2,000 now, startup cost. But everything else is the same. There is no regulation or anything. You just find a place, you just start it up. And of course, there's many more things you can do than bars. But bars are really easy, sort of a starting thing. You could do a little hostel. I've seen so many there. There's no regulations, no anything. You just do it. And very low startup costs. You're not going to make millions and millions of dollars, obviously, but you grow from there, and the place is growing tremendously. So those people who 6-7 years ago started up a bar for a few hundred dollars, many of the bars there now, I know the biggest bars in Phnom Penh, they literally make tens of thousands of dollars a week easily in profit now. So it's grown into a good business for them. And so those are the opportunities. Other regions that I recommend would be Nicaragua, I think, is a good opportunity. It's still very, this is talking about cheap areas to start up where there's very little regulation. Nicaragua, Cambodia, Myanmar, you could take a shot. I'm not sure where it's at. I haven't been there in about 5 years. I hear it's getting better. Anywhere in Africa, but Africa is a real... I don't know enough about Africa to talk about it, but I know that it's very cheap, but it's also... you know, you have to be careful in certain areas and things like that. But it's not as dangerous as everyone says. There's many, many very nice areas in Africa. So, yeah, there's tons of opportunities out there. Other places in South America, Paraguay for sure. I would look at Paraguay. I wouldn't look... Bolivia's... I don't like too much. The government's a little bit too involved in things there. They still have too much government involvement. Places like that. But the main thing is just to take a look around and see which place works best for you and for what kind of business you want to start. But there's nothing but opportunity out there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I realize, like, I know some people in Cozumel, and that's in Mexico for people who don't know. I realize, like, for the last 6 or 7 months, 100% of my income has been online, so I can be wherever I have the internet. And I'm kind of, especially as it's October here and it's getting a little chilly, I'm like, well, what am I doing here? You know, if these opportunities might exist. But I think for a lot of people who are U.S. citizens, Jeff, there's also this apprehension about what the whole going away party is like with the U.S. government, you know, as far as expatriation is concerned. And, you know, are you... to get into specifics a little bit, should people be looking at like work visas? You have this, I think what you described as a permanent traveler status, right?
Right. I live what's called a permanent tourist or permanent traveler or prior taxpayer lifestyle. It's a bit complicated, and I talk a lot about it at the Dollar Vigilante. It's more for people who have a bit of assets and cash. If you're younger and you don't, I wouldn't even worry about those things. And definitely don't worry about work visas. What you want to do is go to a place and start up your own business or even work at a place. People, they don't have these big government regulatory agencies in most of these countries. Not at all, actually. So for example, if you went to Paraguay and you just went to some bed and breakfast run by some American, and you just said, hey, I'm a young guy, I don't have many skills, I'll work here, I'll work my butt off, I'll do anything you need, I'll clean dishes, I'll mop floors, I'll work the front desk, I'll do it pretty much just for lodging and for food for the first month or two, just to learn skills and show you that I have value. And you can do that no problem. There's no way the Paraguayan immigration police are going to show up and ask about your work visa. They don't have things like that in most of these countries. So for younger people, don't even worry about it. Don't worry about the exit party. Just leave. Especially if you have a ton of student loan debt. We just wrote about this in our newsletter at the Dollar Vigilante about how to get out of your student loan debt because so many young people have it. I hear that a lot from people. They'll say, well, I'm 22 years old. I've got a useless Bachelor of Arts degree that is completely useless.
Right.
I have like $80,000 in student loan debt. So I can't, I can't just leave and go somewhere because, you know, I have this student loan debt. It's like, no, just leave, and don't pay it. Because what are they going to do? If you end up in, Mexico or anywhere and you're building a business or whatever, what are they going to do? They can't do anything. And the U.S. government's going to collapse in the next few years, no more than 5 or 10 years. And so that's all going to go away anyway, or the dollar will hyperinflate and then you won't owe anything. Either way, it's going away. And don't get me wrong here about reneging on loans. If you did a private loan with a private person,
right,
you have to pay that back one way or another. You cannot just run away from it. That is not the way to live. You will never have a good life by ripping people off or not doing what you say you're going to do. But when it comes to government loans, student loans, for useless things that turned out to be just a complete useless waste of time, that money was created immorally or unethically by just printing up the money. The government used it to create a student loan bubble, which wrapped a lot of people up into it. So people thought they needed a college education, so they went for it, and then they found out it was a total waste of time, and now they have all this debt. That's actually a trap that the U.S. government is trying to do, is try to get people into student loan debt, because it's the only debt, actually, that in the U.S. you can't absolve through bankruptcy. And so they're trying to enslave young people by doing this. So I have no problem with people who don't pay back their student loan debt in the U.S., because I see the entire thing as a scam and a scheme. But otherwise, when it comes comes to loans, definitely. Yeah. If you borrow from somebody, you have to pay that back. And no matter how long it takes you, you have to, that is just, the only way to live is to always, keep your commitments, unless it's completely impossible. And in that case, you're going to have to just work out some way to resolve it with that person and with yourself, because, that's no way to live a life, by, stealing. It wouldn't be stealing, but it'd be, by not living up to your commitments. That's the number one thing, actually, for entrepreneurs and business people, that you really have to do. There's really two things that I like to say about, you brought up at the start, all the sort of, skills or talents or yeah. ways people should be to be a good business person or entrepreneur. There's really only two that you really, really need. One is show up on time. It's amazing how many people don't do that, to whatever commitment you have. And number two, just do what you say you were going to do. Always live up to your commitments. If you do those two things and you're in business, you're pretty much always going to do well, or at least as good as possible. And you're always, with business, there's always failure, and that's fine. But if you do those two things, you'll do very well in the business world.
Absolutely. And I do want to go back to what you were saying about student loan debt. It seems like if that was an actual conspiracy to enslave people, and I've heard people like, you know, people who don't think too much like you, like Noam Chomsky, say very, very similar things. I think there was a pre-existing model for that. I mean, I had conversations for years with people who would say, yeah, Brett, you know, the things you're saying, that's important, but what do you want us to do? I have a mortgage. Like, people very quickly and kind of unconsciously become enslaved to their comforts. And, you know, they just are stuck in this position, working to survive, gathering all the things that they have and keeping all these things that they've acquired through debt, mostly, close to them. And student loans, probably the most pernicious, because you're going into huge amounts of debt for really nothing. Things that you can totally, as far as knowledge is concerned, you can totally obtain all of that for free today. All you're really paying for is the piece of paper.
Right. And that piece of paper doesn't really matter outside of the U.S. for the most part. Depends which field you're in. If you want to be a doctor, that's a little different. But for most things, even a doctor, actually, you could, in many countries, you don't need to have a doctor diploma to be a doctor. You just start up an office, and if you're good, people will come to you. And if you're bad, you're going to be out of business. And then inside the U.S., because the economy is imploding, and it's going to get much, much worse, through all the regulation, all the taxes, and definitely through the money printing, the inflation. We're seeing all the symptoms of a collapse coming. That piece of paper is pretty much useless for the most part. There's a few that are okay, like I said. But for the most part, any of those bachelor of anything, forget about it. women's studies. You know, it's amazing what some people will, I saw one of those memes on the internet, this, woman, you could tell she was one of those very feminist sort of, and women with the short red hair, haircut, and the glasses, and she said, I have $300,000 worth of student loan debt to get my diploma in women's studies, and now I can't get a job. Now I'm going to occupy Wall Street. It's like, yeah. Well, you know, there is definitely problems, but I think some of those people didn't really think through exactly what they were doing either.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my advice, and this advice was formed as the result of me choking on a pretty bitter pill for about a decade regarding college. You know, understand, like, if you're going to get a degree, if you have no other choice, this is what you want to do, you have to understand what the trends are going to be in that industry over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. My example was, I was a freshman in college in 1995. I graduated in 2000. My degree was in essentially mass communications and journalism. The entire industry was revolutionized while I was in school studying how things were done in the 70s and the 80s. And I had basically a useless degree. I mean, I still wound up, you know, applying that interest anyway to a lot of the work that I did over the course of the next decade. And it's funny that that's kind of like what I'm doing today. It's pretty much a lot of the skills and activities are what I went to school for, what I wanted to learn. Of course, I had to teach myself how to do all of this stuff. And I've had a few mentors and a little bit of guidance along the way. But so that's the advice that I give to kids regarding college. But I think your advice is great. Parents will go for that. Like, hey, save yourself $100,000. Invest in me a couple thousand dollars to travel and see the world. and see where opportunities exist and maybe take advantage of some of them. I think that's fantastic.
Well, one of the things that people might want to do, there is things out there that I think are very valuable. For example, if you're younger, even if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or whatever age, but if you're sort of this mindset that you don't really know much and you want to learn about it, there's things like Exobase or Exosphere, which is like an entrepreneurship school, which is, I think, 2 months long, which you will learn way more in that than you would in business college for 4 years. And actually, we're going to have a two-day what's called Exo Base here at Anarchapoco this February 27th to March 1st. Just check out Anarchapoco. We haven't announced it yet. We're going to be announcing in the next few days something called Exo Base. It's a two-day boot camp for entrepreneurs. You'll probably learn more in those 2 days than you would in a year in college about business. So yeah, and the rest you can learn on the internet. So yeah, this entire model of going for 4 more years after 12 years of indoctrination camp, so 16 years, and you still don't really know anything, is insane.
Right, absolutely. A couple more questions before I just want to finish up today with a speed round from listener-submitted questions. But one thing that I really wanted to make sure we touched on, you and I have met. We've spent some time together. You seem like a pretty relaxed and stress-free guy to me, even though I know you're managing a lot of things. And productivity without stress is a theme that we've tried to hit on pretty continuously over the course of the last year. What would you have to say about work habits?
Work habits. Well, for me, every day of my life, pretty much since I was born, or at least since I've been an adult, which I say was around 14, 15, I pretty much worked every day of my life. When I say I don't like school, it doesn't mean I don't like learning. I literally, when I'm not working, I'm reading. To me, my whole life, I've just tried to improve myself always. Every day, I'm just trying to improve myself. Now, of course, you're going to go through weeks where you don't, but you try to every day just learn something new. It really adds up. So yeah, work habits, I pretty much, and this has actually been a little bit of a detriment now that I have a family and I'm trying to balance it a little bit more now. I've actually decided to take Sundays off for the first time in my life. And actually, it's added a lot to my life. And I found that it actually has helped in some ways, because working constantly, you can kind of get really too focused and you can't see the big picture enough and need to step away every now and then and go to the beach or go with your family or go golf or something like that, get your head outside of it, and then you come back and you're just full of ideas again. So, but in general, yeah, no, I don't understand the people who, oh, I'm going to just work 8 hours a day and eventually I'm going to retire and sit on the beach and at night I'm just going to watch TV. It's like, it's, that seems like just a total waste of time to me. The life is so interesting and there's so many things to explore and to do that I'm just constantly working or learning.
Yeah. Another thing, too, that we've talked about before is deferring happiness, right? Which you just described. People who say, well, I'm going to go through this grind now, so someday, you know, in their short term, like, oh, well, it'll be Friday soon, or I have a vacation soon, or then the ultimate deferment of happiness, I retire someday, and then I can go to the beach. But finding the work that you enjoy, obviously, kind of makes it not so much work.
Yeah, that's the important thing. Find something you enjoy, and that's totally possible. I know a lot of people think that sounds crazy, like that everyone on earth can do something they enjoy. Believe it or not, some people do like just cleaning houses. I've got a maid here at my house. She just likes it. There's just something, it's almost perfect. Like almost everybody has something they like that needs to be done. So just find something that you like. And if you're passionate about something, you can't help but do well at it. And talking about deferring gratification, I remember when I was 18, actually, or 20, I actually decided in my own head that I was going to defer my entire 20s. I wasn't going to do what most people do in their 20s. I was going to hunker down and learn and work for my entire 20s. And my goal was to be a millionaire by the time I was 30. When I turned 30, on that day, I was worth about $120 million. And then I lost most of it. That was the tech bubble and all that sort of stuff, which I learned tremendously from. But that's what it's all about, is deferring. And it's all up to everybody what they want to do. That was my own personal choice. I decided. And then I, throughout my 30s and a little bit of my 40s, I kind of lived like a 20-year-old, which is kind of the funny part. I'd go out and party a lot and do all that sort of thing. So I deferred it. And it actually worked out great for me because I actually didn't really develop physically or mentally until I was in my 30s anyway. So, you know, everyone's just got to decide their own thing. But there's nothing but possibilities out there if you think outside the box a little bit. And don't do it the regular... there's that old saying, if you're doing what most people agree with, or if you're in the majority, you might want to rethink what you're doing. I think that was Mark Twain, and I butchered the quote completely, but the thing today in the U.S. is you go to school for like 20 years, you get out, you're in a ton of debt, and then you just go 9 to 5, work at some crappy job and try to work your way up until you're 65, and then you can go sit on the beach. And what happens with a lot of those people is by the time they turn 65, first of all, their pensions won't be there. But second of all, if they do retire, you hear about so many people going to the beach and just having a heart attack like a week later. It's just this idea of wanting to have like a sitting on the beach when you're 65 is ridiculous. For me personally, I would never want to retire. I always want to do something. The whole idea of retirement sounds like death to me. Why would I just want to sit in a place and play cards all day, and not even, you know, poker, which would be cool because you're trying to make money and learn skills, but, you know, play bridge or something, or play mahjong and watch like soap operas. Like that seems like the worst nightmare ever to me.
So finally, this is actually something I was thinking about myself recently, and I think it's an interesting question. Might be kind of a difficult one, but what would you most like to hear someone overhear, I should say, overhear someone saying about you? Like if someone said, "That's Jeff Berwick, he blank."
Well, it's funny because I do hear that a lot. I've been sort of semi-famous in a few different areas. And I've actually been in an elevator in Vancouver when I was the top tech guy in Canada. And behind me were two guys. And one guy said, "Did you hear what Jeff Berwick did yesterday?" And I'm just like listening. And they didn't know what I looked like. And the other guy goes, "No." And he goes, "He was at a bar. He drove up in his Viper. And he was with like 10 girls. And he drove off all drunk." And the guy said, "Oh, what a jerk." And I was just listening to them like, whoa. So, I don't care what people say about me. I really just don't care. For the most part, those people in that elevator, I don't care what their opinion is of me because they don't matter to me. They don't have their own lives. All they're doing is talking about other people. The only thing I really care is what people who I'm involved with think of me, and that'll be my clients, my family, my friends. Anyone else, I couldn't care less what they think about me. It does not matter, and that's actually a really good way to live life, because if you really worry about what some idiot down the block thinks about you that you have no involvement in, and he doesn't even know you, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, I formulated the question because I recently was going through some Porkfest pictures, and it triggered this memory of being at Porkfest, and it was after the show was pretty big and well-known. And there were people, I kind of like caught out of the corner of my eye, somebody like pointing at me and talking about me. And I was like, what the fuck are they saying? I want to know what they're saying. So like, I started thinking, like, what
he's probably saying, "School sucks. No, Brett sucks."
But what would I like to hear people over saying about he is this, or he did this, or... I thought it was an interesting question to think about, but I totally agree with your answer. If you can't get obsessive about what people might be saying.
Well, what would you like to hear? I'm curious because I can't think of anything I'd like to hear someone say.
I couldn't come up with an answer. So I started like, I was like, who are they? How well do I know them? I think I touched on a lot of the things that you said. Are they a couple of assholes? Are they the two people I'm closest to? You know, is it my girlfriend and my best friend? There's other follow-up questions to that. So I don't know. I mean, but... because you try to put together a biography for somebody, like when I'm going to do an interview. So you're the host, and we'll do your plugs now, too. You're the host of Anarchast, which is a YouTube channel and a podcast where you do discussions pretty similar to this, right? Where you interview people, ask them why they're an anarchist, and then you guys have a conversation in their area of expertise. You are the editor and the creator of The Dollar Vigilante, and you're spearheading this Anarcho Poco, right?
Yep. It's an anarchist conference on the beach, and you've been on Anarchast twice, I believe. And I do many things. But the one other thing I'd like to say about people talking about you is, it's so funny, we live in a world where people take criticism badly. So if you know somebody, like a friend, and he goes, you know, by the way, your breath kind of stinks, a lot of people will go, oh, I hate you. You know, like, why did you? No, take that as like that. That's what I want people to tell me is the truth. So if there's something I'm doing that offends them or something wrong, like your breath stinks, it's like, thank you. Now I'm going to go find out how to fix my breath. You just saved me from everyone thinking my breath stinks, because it does. And so people take criticism the wrong way if it's from people that are actually giving you constructive criticism. Now, if someone comes up and they go, I just think you're a dick, it's like, well, that's not really something I can work on. But I would actually ask them, why do you think that? Is there something I can improve? You know, I'm always just trying to improve, and I never take criticism as being a negative thing.
Absolutely. So I'm looking at the questions that listeners submitted. It looks like a lot of people didn't take it very seriously, Jeff. Is the national government of Ebola in danger of collapse? Can I get Ebola from listening to School Sucks podcast? The only questions, a listener named Daryl Becker, who's actually been on my show a bunch of times, he has a question about HIV and AIDS. He said he'd heard you talk about that before, but I don't see anything here that we can deal with, in just a few minutes, unless you'd want to tackle that. I could read you the question.
Just briefly to answer that, I'm very skeptical of the official story on HIV/AIDS. It makes no sense whatsoever that it started in San Francisco with gay people, and then a bunch of gay people died, and then it was a heterosexual, sexually transmitted disease, which not many people seem to have gotten. Magic Johnson got it, but he's the healthiest looking person on earth. And now it just seems to be in Africa, and a lot of people are dying from it, and now they're vaccinating everyone in Africa. I think there's a lot more to the story than what we were told, especially since Oprah Winfrey in 1987 said that within 3 years, something like 30% of the people on Earth will die from HIV/AIDS. Mm. It's a lot of these things. You just have to question everything, and I question that one as well.
And you've done your own research. I think that was the thrust of Daryl's question. Yeah, I remember it was like around the time when I was becoming sexually active, like the early 90s, and Magic Johnson, then Eazy-E, right? And that was kind of the message in school, is like, you're all going to get AIDS. That's how we believed. Like, that was like something I was afraid of going to college, and then it didn't turn out that way. And it's interesting. I don't know. I haven't done any research myself. The only other question that I think you might like to comment on is the Dark Wallet Project, Cody Wilson's Dark Wallet Project.
Well, I'm huge into anything that's Bitcoin related, and I love what Cody Wilson's doing. He's trying to make it more anonymous. And the thing I really like about how Cody's doing it is he's not mincing words. He's not talking nicely about what he's doing. He's saying straight up, this is going to help people launder money, which is great, because laundering money is not a crime. The crime is taxes. and so I just love the entire, I love everything that Cody's doing. He just did a 3D printed gun that just sold out. Actually, there's another thing, guys, like, he just sold out 1,000 of them at or 300 of them at $1,000 a piece. So he just brought in $300,000, and he hasn't even made one yet. There's so many opportunities out there. So yeah, I love everything he's doing.
And is there last one, I'm sorry, I'm just going through the list, are any concern about the recent dips in Bitcoin?
No, not at all. I see it as a huge buying opportunity. It's still double the price it was a year ago. I think it's not a problem whatsoever. I've been looking at buying more. I was trying to buy some of that big $300 block that was for sale, $7 million of it a few days ago. But I didn't have my money in my account at the time to buy it. But, no concerns whatsoever. Bitcoin is moving on. It doesn't matter what anyone tries to do. They can't stop it. And that's why I love it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate you coming on the show. I look forward to seeing you again sometime in the future, maybe in Mexico.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks, Brett.
All right.
Don't be a bad boy, Johnny.